com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial free, listener sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
To Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM, your community-supported radio station. Sitting in tonight for Egberto Willis, who is off, is Bob Gartner, so he's going to be helping us out at the control board.
Hey, folks.
Yeah.
Good evening.
Say hi to
Bob.
Welcome
to KPFT and Think Wing Radio.
The call-in number tonight, it is open forum, is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. As if that is a new number, I say the number tonight as if that wasn't the number last week and it won't be the number next week. But anyway, 713-526-5738. If there's anything that's been in the news or floating around in your head that you want to talk about, give us a call. Otherwise, I've got some stuff that's kind of been on my mind, and we'll see how that goes. I ran across an article in the Daily Beast. I don't usually follow the Daily Beast, but this was on one of the aggregator pages, and I happened to run across the article. And basically, Anne-Marie Cox, who many of you may know, has, quote-unquote, come out as a Christian. She felt compelled to write this story about her faith. And in some ways, it was I respect her. I understand, I think I understand the feelings behind what drove her to write the article. You know, she's basically a liberal. She's basically a feminist. And these days, those are not the people you think of as quote unquote Christians. Normally these days in this country, Christian is kind of synonymous with right wing conservative, fairly or not. And the story itself, I have a link to it on my blog for tonight's show announcement, thinkwingradio.com or thinkwing.org. And I guess it made me think, because one question that came up is, why would this even be a story? Why would this be a story she would write and the Daily Beast would publish? Why is this a story that I would mention? It's a really good question. And I thought about it. Why she would write it, why I would feel provoked to discuss it. And I came to the conclusion that we are in a place sociopolitically in this country now where politicians and the Christian political right have made religion so front and center in the social and political discourse that it has become a yardstick not only by which politicians are measured, but by which people are measured. She made the comment that she felt like American Christianity, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, so forgive me, but she made a comment to the effect that Christianity in this country today, rather than being an open, welcoming tent for anybody who wants to go to Jesus and feel saved, that it's feeling more like a closed tent, where she almost has to be apologetic to some Christians for being too liberal and some liberals for being too Christian. It really goes back to the First Amendment. I mean, it really does on a socio-political level. It's about whether we should mix church and state. It's about whether religion should be part of our daily discourse, or for those who so choose, simply part of their daily lives. Because there is a big difference between wanting to follow your faith and making your faith a public issue. And I think many Christians have succeeded in making their faith a public issue. I always like to keep in mind that when the Founding Fathers were writing the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, going through all of that political chaos at that time, because as many of you know, the Constitution was the second form of government in the United States, not the first. So there was a lot of political infighting. And, you know, in the late 18th century, there were people whose parents and grandparents who were alive at that time, who remembered things like the Hundred Years' War that filled up much of the 17th century. They understood the problems that could arise from mixing religion and state. They understood that it could cause wars, that it could cause potential genocides, mass slaughter, political and social chaos. They understood that. It wasn't an accident that a separation of church and state was written into the Constitution. The United States was not founded as a Christian country. It was founded as a secular country where you could be Christian, you could be Protestant or Catholic, you could be Jewish or some other faith or no faith. That was the point. It wasn't a Christian country. Now, granted, in the Constitution there are Judeo-Christian ideals. There are also Greek ideals and Mesopotamian ideals and Ten Commandment ideals. I mean, a lot of that factored in. If you look at the Supreme Court building, on the facade, carved into the facade, are various thinkers and influential persons going back thousands of years who symbolically represent the Constitution, the Supreme Court, Western law, Western society. And that's not a religious statement, that's a historical statement. One of the things that I talk about a lot is we really should not have come to a point where we keep religion totally out of schools. Do I mean that we should favor any particular religion in school? Well, if you know me at all, of course not. But I think that religion as a historical and social and political reality has to be taught. I think that, and I mean, this was pointed out to me probably 20 years ago. Comparative religion courses, I think, should be required when you get at the very least to the high school level, if not the junior high school level. You cannot understand history if you don't understand the part that religion has played in history. And if you don't understand history, you cannot learn from it. That's why I often say that there are three versions of history: the winner's version, the loser's version, and the truth. There are many people in the United States who want to teach feel-good history about the United States, stuff that we've done that is good and none of the stuff that we've done that might be bad or questionable, or maybe in the context of its time wasn't bad or wrong, but in subsequent generations has been looked at as imperialistic or aggressive or unfair. You know, one of the things I love to talk about in this regard is the British burning of Washington, D.C. during the War of 1812. I think pretty much every kid who's been through school has learned about the British invading Washington, coming down the Potomac, burning down Washington, and then leaving. It wasn't really a strategic attack. It was actually an attack of retribution, because prior to that, American troops had gone into the city of York, which I believe is modern-day Toronto, which at the time was the capital of British Canada, and we burned York. That's the only reason that the British came down to burn Washington. And weirdly, we don't typically teach that part. The only reason I know that is because the particular history teacher I had in school mentioned it. And when the internet came around in the 1990s and I was able to search it, it took some time to find, but I did find verification of that fact because it was hard to verify. And interestingly, the place it was verified was on a Canadian website. Now think about this. In the United States, we teach the British burning Washington from Canada. So that's like our grudge. We don't teach that it was actually a retaliatory attack for us burning the Canadian capital in York. The Canadians remember. So who are we fooling? If we only learn one side of history, we have not learned history. And if we have not learned history, we cannot learn from history. All of this, I guess, comes from Anna Marie Cox's article. So just to bring it back to the beginning, she felt it necessary to write an article about her Christianity in a way that was almost apologetic. Apologetic to the Christians in this country who are so conservative for being too liberal, and apology to her friends and colleagues and followers who are liberal because she feared that they might consider her too Christian. And it shouldn't be an issue at all. We have an open forum. Phone number is 713-526-5738. If you want to talk about this or any other topic that's on your mind, you don't have to rely on me to bring something up. You can call 713-526-5738. We do have open lines, and Bob Gartner is my stand-in engineer today because Egberto Willis has the night off. Lucky devil. Okay, so we've talked about Christianity and the First Amendment and separation of church and state. A question that has occurred to me over the last few days, those of you who follow the news know that a leading Russian political activist by the name of Boris Nemtsov was assassinated within sight of the Kremlin. You would think that that wouldn't happen much, and that, I mean, consider the Kremlin as like the Capitol or the White House in the United States. Now, it is certainly conceivable that you could get a weapon into that vicinity and assassinate somebody. What is the likelihood these days that you would get out? But they escaped. And for some reason, the surveillance cameras in that area either were not aimed there or were not working. And you had this guy who was a very strong opponent of Vladimir Putin and his politics and his war in Ukraine. And, you know, coming back to the topic again of history, it made me wonder if we need to start thinking about learning the Russian word for Führer. Now, Führer in German means leader. Il Duce in Italian, Mussolini, that also means leader. So I think we may need to learn the Russian word for Führer, because Putin may be headed in that direction. The situation in Eastern Europe is becoming sort of so scary. You look at it, and in a way, Putin's actions, Russia's actions, start to look very Hitler-like. This slow incremental war, the military maneuvers that have taken place near eastern Ukraine and also in a place called Kaliningrad, which is a detached part of Russia, which borders both Poland and Lithuania, which is kind of scary. The increased intrusions into Lithuanian, Latvian, Estonian airspace, Swedish airspace, Finnish airspace, British airspace, American airspace. It's getting really scary, and the Russians, particularly in Putin, don't seem to be in a mood to back down. The fact that they're doing large-scale military maneuvers in Kaliningrad, which, like I said, is this little detached area that's really close to NATO countries, very, very concerning. Okay, we have callers on the line. By the way, there are open lines, 713-526-5738. I'll do a quick ID so I don't have to interrupt our caller. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, your community radio station. Coach Bill, I believe you are up. Bob? Coach Bill, you there? Hello? I can't hear you. okay. Bob is doing the best he can. Is someone on the line with me? Okay, well, we'll wait until that gets straightened out. So, there was an article. Do we have Bob? Bill, are you on the air? No, not yet. Okay. So,
hey,
Mazel Tov. Is this Bill?
Yeah, this is Bill.
You're on the air. You see, all things come to them that wait.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm going to take exception to something you said about religion shouldn't matter in politics.
Okay.
Today there was a good article in the Huffington Post talking about the element of the Christian right that is very wrapped up in end times, apocalypse, and that much of their positions on things like the environment basically, you know, derive from the attitude that we're just not going to be around very long, and so we don't have to worry about clean air and clean water and fossil fuels and carbon and so on and so forth.
I actually have heard that said, yes.
Yes. And that is absolutely something that should be on the table when we're talking about, you know, political positions. The root of those positions and why people take those positions is important.
Well,
absolutely important.
I don't necessarily disagree with you, and I did mention the part about comparative religion so that without teaching favoritism toward any religion, we understand different religions and that they all come in different flavors. There was actually a Reagan official in charge of, I think it was the EPA, who made it very clear. I can't remember his name.
The Department of the Interior, the guy that wanted to, you know, tear down all the forests, James Watt.
James Watt, yes, because he believed that the rapture was coming and it didn't matter.
Right.
And he said it.
Very much infiltrated the Republican Party.
Yes.
Coors beer.
Yeah, must be. Although that's awfully light stuff. I see what you're saying, and in a way I can agree. But I think there's also the question of: do we need to see that as their religion is important, or do we need to see that as their worldview is important to the extent it's shaped by their religion? Should their religion be an issue?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's what I'm getting at, that their philosophy or, you know, the roots of their political positions is absolutely important.
But when James Watt said that he believed that environmentalism didn't matter because the rapture was coming, you didn't need to know his religion to simply take that statement at its face value and say, this is the wrong guy for the Department of Interior.
Sure you had to know. You had to know what the rapture was.
It was useful to know what the rapture was, but just taking him at his word could be enough to know this is the wrong guy. Just taking him at his word.
You know, the I don't know. I mean, I think motivation is important.
It is.
And knowing where someone's motivation is coming from politically is important.
It is. Ah, politically,
and
not religiously
it is also
necessarily.
One of the reasons, you know, that we have, you know, such an opposition to any kind of negotiation or compromise in government right now.
And while those kinds of attitudes may be religiously based, at the end of the day, it's the political reality that you can and should judge them by. For example, if you are a devout Catholic, but you understand the difference between civil law and religious law, your devotion to Catholicism is no longer important because your political and social position is, I believe in civil authority. So what I'm saying is that's the reason I think that religion, while it may be relevant to the foundation of understanding a position, is not relevant to a position per se. The position is the thing that matters.
Well, I mean, I'm not suggesting that we should disqualify someone from, you know, competing in the political marketplace based on their particular religion. Absolutely not.
And yet there has been some of that. You know, in the Republican Party in Texas, there is a House or a Senate speaker, I forget which, I think he's a House speaker, by the name of Strauss. He is the only Jewish Republican in that chamber. And sure. There was an effort to unseat him specifically because the argument was that a Jew cannot govern by Christian values, and therefore they should have a Christian leader. That is true. That was a few years ago. And he was reelected, and he was then reelected recently again after this last election. But that was the foundation of the effort to unseat him, because he was a Jew. So that's the depth to which religion has entered politics now, and that's wrong.
But that is also very much rooted, you know, in the people that were trying to unseat him.
And the people we're electing who are going in there who are making religion a litmus test, which is unfortunate because it's really un-American.
Well, I agree with that. I have absolutely no disagreement with that. But the other thing that has been in the news recently that I also think relates to your general introductory topic is that there's like 18 states now where the single largest religious denomination in terms of self-identification was unaffiliated.
Mm. 10% is atheist.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's fine. But and there's also, depending on what polls you're looking at and how they're asking the questions, you know, the largest growing group is the ones that call themselves spiritual but not religious. So, organized religion is not doing itself any favors with some of its extreme positions. I'm going to, let you get on to somebody else. I do have
Thank
a question.
You. Sure.
Who is this Cox woman?
Anna Marie Cox.
And what she says.
Say that last part again, please.
And why should I care what she has to say?
Well,
I mean, I don't recognize the name. So, you know, obviously she has some celebrity, you know, to have had her article published.
She has some celebrity. She has worked for the Daily Beast for a while. She's been the American correspondent for a British newspaper. I think it was The Guardian, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
She appears quite a bit on various MSNBC shows as a commentator, usually on light commentary. She doesn't usually comment like on Russian politics or something. So she's more sort of a social commentator, social observer kind of columnist.
That's fair.
So her writing of this article, because of her prominence as sort of a liberal feminist, lighthearted in many ways kind of commentator, you know, this for her was a very heavy article. If you are familiar with her.
Well, I said I'm not, but I can appreciate. I can appreciate, you know, what's interesting about the position that she took, and I guess for a. I'm 60 years old. When I was a kid, most of the people I knew belonged to what they used to call mainline, certainly centrist to even left-leaning religious groups. We forget sometimes the extent to which mainstream religious leaders were involved in the civil rights movement.
Jesus
and
was
the
a liberal.
Anti-war movement and so on and so
yeah,
forth.
Yeah, Jesus was a liberal.
Oh, well, absolutely, but I'm talking about, you know, activists that, you know, came out of a, a very Christian background.
Sure.
The civil rights and the anti-war movements. And, of course, you know, they were a little to the extreme, but, you know, they were very solid, centrist Christians of their day.
Yep.
And certainly their congregations were, you know, centrist in their general, political leanings, although the parties weren't nearly as polarized then as they are today.
Well, the Eisenhower platform for the Republican Party actually was, among other things, pro-union.
Sure.
So things have changed a lot. You know, in the last 60 years, things have changed a lot. I appreciate your calling, Bill. I hope you'll call again sometime. I want to go on to the next caller, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, sir. Take care. Have a good night.
Good night.
Okay, we have open lines, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT, and you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Our next caller is Sari, if I'm getting that name correctly. Sari is apparently a first-time listener. You're on the air. How you doing?
Sari, yes, I'm a first-time with you. I'm a visitor to Houston. My daughter lives here. I'm also just by chance, because the whole religion thing, I didn't hear the beginning of your program, but I am a student. I graduated in comparative religions.
Excellent.
I'm 70 years old, and today I would say I am a spiritualist as opposed to religious, but it is very, very frightening if there are a larger amount than one suspects of Republicans in government who think that the end days have come, so who cares what happens to the planet. I had heard that before.
Yeah, there is that fraction. As a matter of fact, I'm going to just make an aside, the Islamic State is actually very much in agreement with them on that regard.
Right, right.
I mean, ironically.
It's a good point. And it seems to be, you know, it just may be the end days because they are creating it. Yes, I definitely believe that this country is, I mean, to start with, what I was called actually about is when you mentioned the burning of Washington, but we don't mention the burning of Toronto or
York.
I heard on the English news on NPR the other day that the reason that Putin and Russia in general is so
paranoid,
so much trying to get power in Ukraine is because, I can't tell you when because I really don't know, but there was an attempt for the European Union or the European whatever is the military
NATO?
Part of the European Union, let's say, to bring Ukraine, to make Ukraine part of the European Union. And there's no way that Russia would accept that they would have the European military forces on their borders.
That is true.
And nobody mentions that. I know, but you never hear that, certainly on CNN, let alone Fox. And again, the Middle East, I mean, this whole mess in the Middle East, if you ask me, other than the fact that it goes back decades and centuries, was definitely stirred up by dear Mr. Bush W.
Yep, I agree.
And nobody thinks about that. I mean, we are the terrorists there. They are a very proud ancient people, and they won't have an occupying force in their countries. I mean, it's all far more complicated. And yet Americans that I've talked to, friends of mine, have said, you know, well, we've got to get rid of them. We've got to destroy them because they might, you know, attack us.
There's a wonderful line from the movie Aliens near the end where Ripley says we should nuke them from orbit. It's the only way to be sure. And whenever I hear those kinds of arguments, that's the line that always comes to mind, because that's kind of your gut impulse. You know, there's a potential enemy out there that potentially could have a knife to your throat, and overkill seems to be the easiest solution. Nuke them from orbit. It's the only way to be sure. But, of course, things are much more complicated than that in real life.
Well, the whole thing is much more complicated than that because you have all the people who make money or get power from little wars that we start around the world and all the rest of it. I live in Venezuela, which is in total meltdown at the moment. I've lived there 46 years. So it's interesting to see powers come and go, and I mentioned that just as an aside. It has nothing to do with the theme at the moment. But
well, in a way it does, because powers do rise and fall, and whenever an empire or a great nation, whatever you want to use as a terminology, depending on time period, feels that their current standing is a natural entitlement, that is when that system is in great danger, because you don't become a great power by accident, and you don't remain a great power by accident, because there's always someone who wants to be a great power in your place.
Right.
Iran had an empire. Lithuania had an empire. In the 13th and 14th centuries, Lithuania pretty much controlled all of Eastern Europe. Down through Ukraine into the Crimea, practically, they were an empire for about 200 years. They were allied with Poland, which also had something of an empire. So, and now they have a country of 3 million people and a little place along the Baltic. So, I mean, things change. Nothing is immutable.
The Austrian Empire.
The Austro-Hungarian Empire, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, we can't always measure the end to a date. Sometimes we can. But generally, whenever that empire ends, there is always, in hindsight, a period of erosion that usually takes place over anywhere from 20 to 200 years, depending on the kind of situation we're talking about. Like the Roman Empire, I think, was destroyed in 453, the Western Empire. And you could argue that they were in decline for at least 200 years before that. So when I look at the situation in the United States, we are a great power. We are a rich power. Now, how we divide that wealth is something else again. But as a nation, we are a rich power. But we are not an infinitely rich power. We have limitations. And the more we... I think what a lot of conservative war hawks don't understand is that military power grows out of economic power. They are not separate things. And if you don't take care of your economy, your military must wither. Just ask the Soviets.
They had
a great military until their economy collapsed.
No, you're out of my league because I really can't comment, but it does make sense, obviously.
Well, I'll go back to your original point because you raise a fair question about the EU. I don't know that they offered membership to Ukraine. And actually, this was pretty well covered at the time. It's gotten kind of lost because of the conflict being the central story. But at the time, the question was, would the Ukraine accept a financial support offer from Russia? Who, by the way, has been gouging them terribly on the pricing and supply of natural gas. Or did they want to, and they had a Soviet-style dictator in there, or did Ukraine want to be more associated with Western Europe and incorporate themselves culturally and financially into the West? And even though the West was not offering quite as comprehensive a financial package, but seemed to be offering them more in the way of economic and political opportunity. And of course, with Russia, when you look at the EU, there's also the association of NATO. Now, keep in mind that at the time, Russia was permitted an observer at almost every NATO meeting. In other words, Russia, to a greater or lesser extent, and I think that, the Republican Congress from 1994 on, they wanted to punish Russia at the end of the Cold War. And I think that that was a terrible, terrible turning point, historically speaking. The Russians did have sort of a seat at NATO. They didn't get to the most top secret meetings, but for the most part, they had transparency with NATO's plans. Now, does Russia historically have reasons to be paranoid? Yeah, they've been invaded a lot. They have an enormous country. There's always somebody somewhere on their border that wants to invade them. They were invaded after the Bolshevik Revolution in the 19-teens and 20s by the British and the French, and I think to a lesser extent with American assistance. So, yeah, they have their reasons to be paranoid. But I think there's also an element of there was something of a clean slate after the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was an opportunity, and the EU was, I think, very much willing, as well as the United States, to see Russia try to integrate itself more into the socioeconomic life of the West. And as it happened, that was a choice that eventually they decided not to make, institutionally speaking. So now we're in a situation where they're very geographically and politically aggressive. They've taken over parts of adjacent former Soviet republics like Georgia. They have taken over, although they deny it. You know, if you remember when the Eastern Ukrainian rebellion first started, and there were talks, especially in the Crimea, oh, you've got guys in Soviet uniforms driving Soviet trucks or Russian trucks. They have to be Russians. And Putin just dismissively said, oh, well, you know, there are army surplus stores. You can get Russian uniforms anywhere. So it's like, okay, and I'm guessing now, looking at the situation, that those same military surplus stores are also selling Russian tanks, Russian artillery, Russian anti-missile missiles. You know, I mean, let's get real. There's no way that the rebels could have this stuff without the Russians sending it in, period.
Right, right. Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that, but I don't think it's very comforting to think that the Americans are starting getting more involved over there.
Well,
I really don't know what the answer is. I don't pretend to go there.
Well, Ukraine is not in NATO, but the Baltic states are, and Poland is. And now we're talking about conflict approaching their borders, or a hostile state, potentially hostile state, being on their borders. And NATO has the contractual obligation to help them if necessary. I will point out, and this is something that is not widely known, although it was reported, after 9/11, after the attack on the World Trade Center, when all the planes in North America were grounded, and I mean, literally the sky was clear of aircraft for the first time since the early 1900s, and our NATO allies in Europe actually offered us assistance for guarding our borders and our airspace. And the Bush administration declined, presumably out of a sense of false pride. We don't need no help from you guys. We help you. You don't help us. I think it would have been a great gesture, politically and financially, to allow them to give us some temporary assistance militarily, if for nothing else as a gesture of goodwill, to show that the support is mutual. I think that would be a really, really important concept.
Well, it's not surprising, seeing who was president, that that didn't happen. But, yeah, the day that there's more brotherhood in the leadership, in the military leadership of the planet, that'll be quite some day.
I think it was just a terrible mistake to decline that kind of geopolitical military reciprocity.
Yeah.
It would have been an enormous gesture of goodwill from them to us after what many Americans feel is a one-sided relationship from us to them.
Right, right. Well, and many Americans think that we are the police state of the world. Americans, let alone those that are policed, think it. Right. And that we ought to be, and that we have a right to be. That's the part that, you know, kind of sticks in your craw.
A new
anyway,
form of
I'll let you go
destiny.
On to someone else, but it's very interesting. I'm glad I happened to turn on the radio.
Thank you, sorry. I appreciate your listening, and I appreciate your calling, and tell your family to listen sometime.
Okay.
All right, take care. Have a good trip.
I wish I could.
All right.
Okay.
Take care now.
Good night.
Good night. Okay, we have open lines, 713-526-5738. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM, 713-526-KPFT. Bob, you had some thoughts?
Oh, well, just a small thing. I happen to know that Sari is a donor to the station.
Oh,
I've taken pledges from
thank
her during
Sari
drive before. So from myself, thank you very much, Sari, for supporting KPFT.
Yes, we do appreciate that. Okay, so that was an interesting discussion. A couple of very interesting callers there.
Yes, and that number again to call if you'd like to be on the air is 713-526-5738. We've got about 22 minutes left, and we'd be happy to have you speak and share your thoughts tonight.
Absolutely. Open forum. You know, you can talk about anything we've been discussing or anything else that's caught your attention in the news or that you've been thinking of in your mind, some deep existential question. We can do existential. You know, one of the topics that we touched on in the course of our talking so far is the end of timers, the end of the worlders, those Christians and people of other religions who believe that there is going to be something like a rapture, and you may call it different things in different faiths, but some kind of a rapture where at the end of the world, the good, if you will, I can't think of the word I prefer, the righteous, I think that's the word I'm looking for, that the righteous will go to heaven and sit by the foot of God, and the others will, you know, go to hell or stay on earth, which may be the equivalent of hell at the time. There is a similarity between Christians who believe in the end times and the Islamic State, which believes in the end times. There was a great article, and really I do encourage folks to go to my website, thinkwingradio.com or thinkwing.org, not just because I would love to get visitors, which I would, and not just because I would love to get clicks on my links, because I would, but I do try to put access there to many different things. So like even at the end of this week's show or last week's show, there are probably at least half a dozen links to articles and information and sites, some of which end up getting discussed, some of which I thought about discussing, but we never got to. And one of the articles, actually now two of the articles that I have linked on a couple of my blog posts, have to do with what does ISIS want. I talked about this a little last week. I didn't have much time. I put a couple of minutes into it. But this is a great article. I mean, if you want for the first time for your mind to be able to wrap around why ISIS does the things they do, are they just a bunch of psychotic killers who do it for the thrills of these horrible sorts of executions? Or is there some kind of an underlying reason and philosophy and religious or political ideology behind it? And this article by, what's his name, Graham, Graham something. I have the link on the website. And it's a long article. I mean, you would have to figure to sit down and read it over about an hour. It's a long article, very informative, but long. Easy reading, easy comprehension. And for the first time after reading that article, I and many, many others felt for the first time they had some grasp of what we're dealing with the Islamic State. So, in that context, one of the things that I hope that I thought we would discuss last week, except it ended up being all about the post office. Bob's laughing, but it was about the post office. One of the things I wanted to get into was, is Islam a religion of peace? That seems to be the burning question that's going on sort of around the Western world. Is Islam a religion of peace? I would extend that question. Is Christianity a religion of peace? Is Judaism a religion of peace? Or for that matter, is Buddhism a religion of peace, given the fact that you have occasionally had militant, violent Buddhists? And I think at the end of the day, one of the points I would make is that at the end of the day, every religion pretty much is a religion of peace, and every religion in one way or another is a religion of war. If anybody preached peace, according to the New Testament, and I'm no expert, but from what I understand growing up in a Judeo-Christian country, it was Jesus. Moses didn't go around preaching a lot of peace. Abraham didn't go around preaching a lot of peace. Jesus preached a lot of peace. So you would think that Christianity, especially given its history over the first 100 years of its existence, would be more or less a religion of peace. Christians have been very, very good at making war, making religious war. Whether it's religious war against the Muslims, or religious war against other versions of Christianity, or religious war in a form against the Jews, various things that have been done to the Jews in terms of driving them out of Spain, the pogroms that took place in Eastern Europe, the limitations on land ownership, the deprivation of family names. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. You know, every ethnic group has a historic grievance. But I think this question of, is Islam a religion of peace? Well, you've got Christian end-of-worlders. Are they necessarily peaceful? There are Christians that support Israel specifically because they believe that the final battle of the end times before the second coming will take place in Israel. And that is their reason for supporting Israel. It's not for any particular love of Jews. It's because they believe that Jesus will return in Israel. So anything that brings about the potential for that second coming is something that many Christians who believe in that form of Christianity, many Christians take very, very seriously. Should we see those Christians as being end of timers who pose a threat? Maybe, maybe not. But the vast majority of Christians who, whatever their personal beliefs or interpretation of their Bible and their faith, just kind of live their lives like everybody else. They go to work, they go to Starbucks, they go to movies, they have family dinners, they have family arguments, they have feuds between cousins and aunts and uncles. They're just like everybody else. That, at the end of the day, is Muslims. Whatever it is that's in the faith, whatever interpretation Westerners think, because there was certainly a period where Islam was spread by the sword. Well, there was a time when Christianity was spread by the sword. Did Jesus preach that? Not to my knowledge. Did Muhammad preach that? I don't know much about Islam, but maybe, from my very, very cursory understanding, but is any of that relevant? You can believe that Jesus is the Son of God and is also God, the Holy Trinity. You can also believe that Muhammad is the final prophet and believe in Islam and believe that Mecca is the holy city. You can believe all of that without necessarily going around cutting people's heads off with a knife. I've had many Muslim friends and acquaintances and business associates. They've been Iranian, they've been Persian, they've been Palestinian, they've been Pakistani, they've been Indian Muslims, as well as Indian Hindus and people from Saudi Arabia. And I have one friend of the family who's an Israeli-Palestinian citizen or Palestinian-Israeli citizen. You know, there's a whole wide world out there of all kinds of people. And certainly cultures matter. But to say a religion is a religion of peace or a religion of war to me is not a meaningful discussion. It comes down to groups and what those groups want to do. So that may get a couple of things going. Hopefully, we have a couple of calls on the line. I hope I get to them fairly quickly because we have about 12 minutes left. Bob, can you hook someone up through me? Okay, well, it's time for a station ID anyhow. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, your community radio and community-supported radio station. And we'll have our callers on the air in just a moment. Let's see. So we talked about, I think it was kind of interesting, we talked with Coach Bill about James Watt in the Department of the Interior during the Reagan administration, and how he actually said during an interview something to the effect, oops, we dropped somebody. If you will call back right away, we're just working on it here. So I apologize for that call being dropped. Just call right back if you would, please. So James Watt of the Interior Department in the 1980s, when asked about why he doesn't seem that concerned about conservation and why he doesn't seem that interested in protecting forests and national monuments and national parks and those sorts of things. And he actually said something to the effect that, well, the end times are coming anyhow, and when the rapture comes, none of that stuff will matter, so we might as well just enjoy it now. Okay, I've got Wayne on the line. Bob, can you get him on the air for me? Wayne, are you there?
Hey, Mike, how Muzzle you doing
up.
Tonight?
Hey, Wayne, how you doing? You're on the air now.
I'm good. great show, man. You're having a good conversation.
Thank you.
Well, really what I was calling to ask was, I was trying to remember, I might be getting a little old here.
Ha! You and me both.
Even if you know, and it wouldn't be a... but when Thurgood Marshall did the school thing.
Brown versus Board of Education.
Brown versus Board of Education. Wasn't he, didn't he do that pro bono? And wasn't he a college student at the time? He wasn't a Supreme Court justice at that time, was he?
That's a great question. I, at one time, thought he was on the Supreme Court at that time, but you're right. I believe that he argued the case as a lawyer before the Supreme Court.
But he did that pro bono, right?
He may have. I cannot swear to that either way. I just don't know. It was, I only recently found out that he did it as a lawyer rather than a judge. But, yeah, he presented that case, and that really, I think, was the foundation of his nomination and eventual ratification as a judge on the Supreme Court.
Okay, okay. Because I was thinking that when, as history goes, that it tells us that he done it as a college student and pro bono. He wasn't even a full-fledged lawyer at that time.
That would surprise me, but I can't say yes or no because I just don't know, but you've made me curious.
Okay, well, let's
Well, if you've made me curious, that's already part of the job of you calling, right?
Yeah, well, let's check into that. Let's talk about that.
Okay.
Let's do that. Okay, I would say something about the Supreme Court justice and this thing that's going on now. And
the Obamacare case?
Yeah, the Obamacare case thing. I really want to see these Supreme Court justices try to come to a mutual agreement on this, because what I'm seeing here now, is that I think that some Supreme Court justices have tied themselves to Obamacare, and they came back out of it now.
There have been some articles along those lines that Chief Justice Roberts has kind of sort of created the case for preserving Obamacare.
And he should have.
And he should have, but, you know, there are a lot of things that oughta, coulda, shoulda. But the question is whether he has enough legal and personal investment in not seeing it destroyed.
Well, you know, Mike, I'm a kind of forward-looking and thinking person, and I kind of see where this is headed when they try to use the tax thing as a parameter for this here.
Yeah, it's not a fee; it's a tax.
Yeah,
that was an important legal distinction.
And I think that when it was said and done, and they haven't really thought this through, that what they're going to open the door to is universal health care. Because if they deem that states cannot say that they don't have to pay this tax, or they can't use it under that, well, then I think the Supreme Court has to go back and say, okay, well, if you don't think that it should be done that way, then let's make it universal health care. And I think the Supreme Court is going to have to weigh in on that.
Well, as I understand the essence of the case, apparently there are four particular sentences in the law that raise the question of whether the federal government can offer a subsidy if the state has not opted into the expanded Medicaid system.
Okay.
So it's a very, very fine point of language in law. So apparently in law there is a tradition of looking at a law in terms of its intent and not necessarily looking especially in a very large law where there's a lot of text, and not looking at four sentences that seem to contradict the rest of the body of the law.
Yeah, so, you can't take I understand what you're saying. You can't take just one small part of it and try to finalize it.
Right. Now, part of the problem here is that because of a legislative oversight, there should have been a sentence, and this goes back to the original case, there should have been a sentence in the law that said something to the effect that if any part of this law is deemed to be unconstitutional, it will not affect the standing of any of the other parts of the law. And in the rush to finally get this thing done against all of this opposition that was extant at the time, that sentence, which is standard, somehow got left out, which raised the question in the initial case of whether blocking out one part of the law as unconstitutional would invalidate the entire law. So that's kind of where we are again, except now, having accepted the fact that it's understood that you don't have to kill the whole law if one part of it is invalid. Now the question is, if you strike down this one part, which is really what's being contested, then about 7 to 11 million people, I don't remember the exact number, will lose their subsidies and then not be able to afford health care. So
but
they'll go from having health care to not having health care overnight.
But isn't there something in the law that states that if a harm has been done to you, now if you give me something and you take it away, and I'm using it to do something for me, and by you taking that away it harms me, then that's unjustified too, right?
I don't know of that particular kind of precedent in law. Now, what I will say on a pragmatic level is if these subsidies are struck down, because this is sort of a public-private partnership sort of law, there are going to be an awful lot of medical insurance companies that are going to be really, really unhappy because they're suddenly going to lose millions and millions of customers. So,
but they're going to also, it's going to also hurt the people that it's intended to help.
Let's assume for the moment that there are people in our government who just don't care.
Okay.
All right, let's assume that for the moment.
We can assume that for sure.
We can assume that for sure. So I'm being a little bit sarcastic when I say that.
Okay.
But they do care about big insurance companies that provide them with hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars in political contributions who would suddenly lose millions of customers paying hundreds of millions and billions of dollars in medical premiums.
Right.
So there's hope based on greed.
Okay.
Sometimes you do the right thing for the wrong reasons, and that's what we can hope for.
And that's how. And ain't that how Medicaid and Social Security and all those things came about?
You know, it's always a matter of sort of making a compromise between our angelic parts of our nature and our devilish parts of our nature. And as they say, the devil is always in the details.
Yeah.
But, you know, as a belief system, true conservatism, which, by the way, we do not have in this country right now. We have is reactionaries.
Now, what we have is stingy people. That's what we have. But
well,
go ahead, Al.
Yeah, because these people are not true conservatives. True conservatives don't necessarily abhor change. They
right.
abhor sudden change. They abhor untraditional change. It takes them time to get used to things. We now have so-called conservatives that want policies even if they are proven not to work. They want them on principle, even if time and again they have failed.
Yeah.
So these people are not conservatives. By any definition historically, these are not conservatives. We call them conservatives, and they call themselves conservatives, but really they're something else entirely.
Mm-hmm.
So to get back to the question of the Supreme Court, in principle, the Supreme Court is supposed to be apolitical.
Right.
They're
exactly.
Not, exactly. But you have individuals on the Supreme Court. I mean, everybody at some point in their lives has suggested some particular bias toward one kind of belief system or another. I don't care how impartial you are. I think that I can be an impartial person if I was on a jury, but that doesn't mean I don't have opinions.
Okay.
I can set opinions aside based on facts and law. I may hate the law, but I understand the difference between what I prefer and what is law. So
all laws are not good laws.
That's true, but sometimes you have to obey the law. Now, they do have something, I think it's called something like jury nullification. There are occasions where a jury can simply ignore the law and make a ruling, and then the judge has to decide whether to accept that ruling. So there is that provision. Actually, I think we need to start going to music now, because I think at 10:58... we have to start going into the public. I'm sorry, I'm talking to Bob right now. I think at 10:58 we start going into our public service.
But Mike,
yeah.
let's pick this conversation up next Wednesday.
Absolutely, and I appreciate your calling, Wayne. You're always a fun guy and interesting to talk to.
All right, thank you, man.
Thank you.
Right.
Okay.
Mike, I just wanted to say I think you ought to pick that last topic up again soon. That's very intriguing, and I'd like to hear some more discussion.
I appreciate
it.
That. Yeah, we can do that again. Maybe sometime
sit
in and help with the chat.
What Wayne shared and was interested in by any means.
And it's probably by next week, no matter what the opinion is about. I don't think they're going to release a decision on that probably for a few months. Oops. Okay. But in any case, if we could go to our outro music. I think we need to start getting ready for the next show. Okay, I'll settle. Not my usual outro.
The following program may contain language or imagery that may be offensive to some listeners. Discretion is advised. The Federal Communications Commission permits the broadcast of some profanity during hours deemed to be safe harbor, when children are less likely to be listening. KPFT upholds a stricter policy, permitting the broadcast of sensitive material only between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. The FCC forbids the broadcast of some sexual discussions or other suggestive matters, regardless of the hour. If you have any questions or concerns, please call the program director during business hours at 713-526-4000. This is KPFT Houston.
Yeah, man, what's happening, man? Eyes on Me Radio. This is DJ Overflow. It is 10:59, 11 o'clock. Houston's own 90.1.